skip ahead about 40 seconds if the resources I've been giving bother you. There is a crisis text line set up for those suffering from anxiety or depression. Text 741-741 for help. If you're experiencing suicidal thoughts, please call the National Suicide Hotline at 1-800-273-TALK or 8255. If you're suffering from domestic violence, please call 1-800-799-SAFE or 7233 or dial 911. The Trevor Project has a hotline for young LGBTQ people who are struggling. Call 1-866-488-7386. Remember, you are not alone. I'll have international resources as well as these U.S. numbers in today's show notes. Southern Fried True Crime covers cases that are not suitable for young listeners, and there may also be some explicit language used. Listener discretion is advised. The word murderous rolls off your tongue like a dry white wine, a whisper. We call women who kill their husbands black widows. I've mentioned this before. Black widow spiders are infamous for their sexual cannibalism. The sex is intrinsic to the murder. In most of the black widow cases I've covered, the wives had multiple affairs and were seen as promiscuous. I think that's why the case of Blanche Taylor Moore was so sensational. The 57-year-old grandmother was accused of poisoning her husband. She was not your typical femme fatale. She was a preacher's daughter, and later, a preacher's wife. She held the facade of a lovely Christian woman. But under that facade were many layers to the real Blanche, and many dead bodies in her wake. Welcome to episode 101, The Preacher's Daughter. Blanche Taylor Moore was born in February of 1933 to parents Parker Davis Kaiser, known as PD, and Flonnie Blanche Honeycutt Kaiser. Blanche was the fifth child born of seven to P.D. and Flonnie. P.D. Kaiser was what author Jim Schutz called a primitive preacher. These ministers are an offshoot of Baptists, a fundamentalist sect believing in absolute predestination. They are called by God. They do not require an education in ministry. These small congregations were formed in the southeastern region of the United States. And the word primitive is meant as being original, not simple or crude. They do not believe in tithing, or rather supporting the salary of a preacher, which is ironic, because that's why P.D. supposedly did it. He moved from place to place in urban areas and followed the code of lyrical preaching and a cappella singing only. No musical instruments were allowed. He moved his family from Concord to Burlington, North Carolina, when Blanche was 9 years old. He began working on and off in the mills there, and Flonnie worked full-time in the mills, backbreaking work to support her family. P.D. was hard-drinking and also a womanizer, often from the women in his short-lived congregations. Flonnie wasn't blind to this and put up with it, but P.D. abandoned his family near Christmas of 1956. Blanche was already married and out of the house by then. She married James Napoleon Taylor in May of 1952, 7 years before her mother had to file for divorce and publicly state that her husband said he was leaving her to find a younger woman. The court awarded alimony, and evidently, P.D. paid it. It was not an auspicious beginning for young Blanche. Along with hard drinking, P.D. was abusive, physically and emotionally. And according to the Jim Schutz book, Preacher's Girl, he forced Blanche into having sex with the men he owed money to. I really liked Mr. Schutz's book, but that did raise an eyebrow. as that allegation probably came from Blanche herself, or possibly her last husband. A critic of the book said there was no proof and called it, quote, tabloid shallow. I disagree. Well, I agree there is no proof, but there are aspects of Blanche's personality that align with the behavior of abuse victims. Sexually abused children often become promiscuous, not always, of course. But experts have understood this behavior and studied it for decades. Other symptoms are depression, anxiety, and anger, impulsive behavior, and physical symptoms like gastrointestinal issues. For most of her adult life, Blanche suffered from many of these issues, and we don't just have her word for it. Many people around her knew it. She complained of chronic diarrhea, and later with a psychiatrist, her depression and anxiety became well documented. She often behaved inappropriately. For the most part, Blanche was a Christian woman, and that is what people saw. Then they would be shocked when she would make a sexually suggestive remark or tell an obscene joke. She might have gone to trial at the age of 57, but as a young woman, she was exhibiting this behavior during the much more conservative 1950s and 60s, and she had numerous affairs and did little to hide them. But she also put up with a great deal of abuse, according to her daughters. Dysfunctional relationships and putting up with abuse is another part of the PTSD of childhood sexual abuse. When Blanche was finally caught for her crimes, the prosecution had a difficult decision to make about what they presented at trial. Some evidence would allow in testimony about the abuse she had suffered. But Blanche had tortured and murdered at least one man by then, and was suspected in other deaths and one attempted murder. In the lead prosecutor's opinion, any abuse she suffered was no excuse. I'm going to pause now for a short commercial break. By the time of Blanche's first marriage, she had quit school. Before she had even quit, she was already working at department stores in downtown Burlington to buy her own clothes. All her life, she was known for being an immaculately dressed woman. Most photos you find of Blanche online show her at the time of trial, in her late 50s. As a young woman, she is described as very beautiful. She had jet black hair and high cheekbones, indicating a strong Native American ancestry. She was also voluptuous. She was curvy and proud of her small waist. Her hair was always perfect, and she was rarely seen without makeup. As I said, she married James N. Taylor in May of 1952 when she was 19 years old. He was 5 years older than her. Born in 1927 in South Carolina, James was one of 11 children in a very clannish family. In The Preacher's Girl, he is described as uneducated and kind of the black sheep of the family. He needed family loans to get his first house and to help him out often. But he was also a World War II veteran and was known to be gifted at restoring and rebuilding fine furniture. Within the first year of their marriage, Blanche gave birth to their daughter named Vanessa. 6 years later, Cynthia, known as Cindy, came along. Right after Vanessa's birth, Blanche started working at the Kroger on Church Street in Burlington as a checkout girl. She would work for Kroger for 32 years, but almost from the beginning, her ambition took her to the highest rank as a female checker could get. She was a head cashier, which meant she supervised other cashiers, bag boys, and stockers. She was also responsible for training new cashiers. And her Kroger co-workers learned early on that Blanche was willing to play all the games to get what she wanted. People would stand in line to wait for her to check them out. It wasn't just men wanting to flirt with the beautiful Mrs. Taylor. Women loved her too. She unfailingly remembered names and could always remember to ask about an ailing family member a customer had recently told her about. Customers loved her, but her co-workers were wary. They told author Jim Schutz that she flirted with management from the beginning to work her way up. One co-worker told the LA Times, quote, If you got on her bad side, she could be vindictive. Another coworker told the same paper, quote, "Everyone thought she was two-faced. She could be underhanded." And apparently some cashiers felt she played hard and loose with the money bags and moving registers around. In later years, a money bag would come up missing, but an investigation proved nothing. And then there were the affairs. By 1959, the year her mother filed for divorce, Blanche was promoted to head cashier, and her relationship with James was falling apart. According to friends and family, his aging played a part in this. Now in his 40s, James was balding and growing a belly, and Blanche had lost interest in him sexually. She started selling Tupperware, and this was her usual excuse for being away at night. But the family had one car, and James constantly questioned her on how she was able to use a company Kroger car after hours. Co-workers recalled an ugly scene to author Jim Schutz when a drunken James came into the store to confront his wife and the assistant manager she was having an affair with. He screamed at him, "Are you fucking my wife?" before he was escorted off the premises. Jim Schutz wrote of more abusive scenes in the marriage in his book Preacher's Girl that had to have come either from Blanche herself or her daughters. One was where James kept throwing pudding in his wife's stoic face as she refused to answer him about where she was going or if she was having an affair. And another, violent incident, where after fighting with Blanche about getting into the car, he slammed the car door and it caught her coat, and then he drug her down the street. Not long after this scene, he had what his doctors called a fairly serious heart attack. It isn't clear if he had eaten anything beforehand, but he was short of breath, vomiting, and had diarrhea. These symptoms would become more common later. James was also a drinker and a gambler, but by the early 60s, he had joined a Baptist church and really tried to be a good father and to turn his life around. Blanche had always been close to James's mother, Isla. She seemed to seek her out, to sit by her at family functions. She courted his mother early in their relationship, but she would criticize James to Isla, who would just pretend not to notice. His sisters, particularly Dot, came to hate Blanche. Dot accused Blanche of constantly dumping her daughters on their elderly grandmother instead of caring for them herself. I mean, sure, but as Blanche put it, they did also have a father. In September of 1966, Parker Davis Kaiser died suddenly at the age of 62. Cause of death was ruled to be heart disease. He had been a heavy drinker and smoker, so no one really questioned his death. At least not then. Then in November of 1970, Isla Taylor, Blanche's mother-in-law, who had become more critical of Blanche, fell ill. She was bedridden and died at home. Her official cause of death was a cerebral hemorrhage. Just a few years prior, Blanche had met a young assistant manager at Kroger named Raymond Reed. He was 3 years younger than her and came from Virginia. He was married to a woman named Linda, and they had two sons together. According to Jim Schutz, Raymond was on to Blanche's affairs early on. Her affairs with assistant managers, while technically forbidden in the chain supermarket, were mostly ignored. Cannily, Blanche understood this implicitly and sought to befriend Raymond, not seduce him. But when he was made the manager, she became more determined. She knew Raymond was into televangelists like Jimmy Swaggart, so Blanche started watching too. Then she had something to chat with Raymond about. In 1971, Raymond and Linda Reed divorced. In the months following, co-workers say Blanche and Raymond were now having an affair and James knew about it. In September of 1973, 45-year-old James Taylor started having symptoms of what he thought was the flu. He had a sore throat and swollen glands and horrible diarrhea. His hair was falling out, and he developed blisters on his hands and feet. He went to his doctor, but the doctor had no idea what was wrong and kept sending him home. The details of his symptoms and the night of his death all come from Jim Schutz's book, Preacher's Girl. Blanche's daughter, Cindy, 14 at the time, would have been the witness to this. Vanessa was 20 years old and had already moved out of the house. On that last night, James didn't feel like eating dinner. So Blanche gave him ice cream to soothe his sore throat. About an hour later, he was writhing in pain and started vomiting violently. Blanche told Cindy she would call the doctor in the morning and then made a bed for herself on the sofa. The next morning, she found James dead. He had died on the morning of October 2, 1973, from what the doctors ruled to be a massive heart attack. His sister, Dot, later told the Charlotte Observer that, quote, "It seemed kind of odd. All the rest of us lived to be a ripe old age. James was very young. We had a premonition something wasn't right. We just couldn't put our hands on it." But his death certificate noted he had a 4 to 5 year history of heart issues. After her husband's death, Blanche remained in a relationship with Raymond for 16 years without getting married. Raymond did want to get married, but Blanche didn't. She later said these were some of the happiest years of her life. She had independence. In 1983, a man named Robert Hutton worked as his own manager at the same Kroger Blanche worked for. Jim Schutz used a pseudonym for Hutton in his book, but his real name is all over newspapers and court documents. I think the pseudonym was because Hutton alleged that Blanche had come on to him, that she was constantly flirting and telling him dirty jokes. And yet she filed a sexual harassment lawsuit for $14 million against him and Kroger in 1985. Hutton was forced to admit under oath many sexual indiscretions with female co-workers, as well as his relationship with Blanche, which she denied. According to author Jim Schutz, who had access to court records, Robert Hutton said that Blanche had set him up. He said she lured him up to an office and got him to take his pants off. Then she grabbed his pants and underwear and ran out of the store, leaving Hutton to walk out exposed. He yelled at one of the meat cutters to bring him a smock, and that's how he got out of the store. The lawsuit between Blanche, Hutton, and Kroger was long and grueling. Hutton was allowed to resign with a post-dated document so he would receive his full retirement benefits, while Blanche continued her battle with Kroger. During this time, a house she had bought after James's death burned down, and then a trailer she bought after that had a similar fire. Both fires were arson. Blanche allegedly said it was, quote, "some pervert," but she couldn't name the person. She received insurance settlements for both fires. During the legal battle with Kroger, she saw a psychiatrist who noted severe depression and suicidal ideation. Later in court, he would slip and admit that Blanche implied her relationship with Richard Hutton was consensual. He read quotes of things she said in court, and one of them was, quote, "finally broke with Hutton because it was just plain sinful." This all came out later in her criminal trial. At the time, she settled her lawsuit with Kroger for $275,000. That was a lot of money then, and for perspective, it's worth about $646,000 today. Raymond, Blanche's boyfriend, had been caught up in the lawsuit with Kroger. He was also a manager, and he had a consensual relationship with Blanche. It was ugly all around. Now Blanche wasn't working and complained of chronic diarrhea. To make matters worse, a mass was found in one of her breasts. She had to have a mastectomy. For a woman like Blanche, who loved her curves and liked to wear clothes to accentuate her enviable figure, this had to be a hard blow. She would eventually have reconstructive surgery. On Easter Sunday of 1985, she went to the Carolina Church of Christ with her sister. She caught the eye of Reverend Dwight Moore. From all accounts, he pursued her, not the other way around. He called her all the time and left notes at her home. Accounts differ on whether there was overlap. Her daughters told the LA Times that Blanche and Raymond's relationship had cooled when she started seeing Dwight. And Dwight was under the impression that Blanche was just friends with Raymond. When Raymond became deathly ill to the point of hospitalization, The Reverend drove Blanche to the hospital to see him. He would then accompany her to Raymond's funeral. I'm going to pause to hear a word from today's sponsor. Researching true crime is about peeling back layers to uncover the mystery. That's also what is fun about the puzzle game, Best Fiends. Reaching each new level feels like uncovering a new layer in a story, one you get to take part in. I love that the longer I play it, the more challenging it becomes. Right now, I am on level 158, and I've upgraded a new fiend named Buggles. The new place I'm in is called the Ominous Ocean, and it's super cool. Best Fiends has challenging puzzles, but still, it's casual enough for anyone to play, though it is designed for adults. I compete with my family and friends, and I can play whenever I have time, like when I'm drinking my morning coffee. And you can play it anywhere. That's one of the best parts. Best Fiends does not require the internet to play. And Best Fiends updates the game monthly, with new levels and events, so it never gets old. Best Fiends has thousands of levels already, with new levels, events, and characters added every month. It's hours of fun, right at your fingertips. You can even play offline. With over 100 million downloads and tons of five-star reviews, Best Fiends is a must-play. Download Best Fiends free on the Apple App Store or Google Play. That's friends without the R, Best Fiends. Raymond's illness started on January 1st, 1986. He ate Blanche's potato soup and became ill with gastro symptoms, vomiting, and diarrhea. He was sick on and off for the next few months. He took 4 weeks off work in total, something that was out of character for Raymond. He went to work on May 29th, 1986, for the last time. On May 30th, 1986, Raymond got sick again. He was having the same symptoms as before, but now he had lost feeling in his extremities. His doctor sent him to Wesley Long Community College, where Raymond told the doctors that he hadn't been able to keep anything down since a supper he had eaten a week earlier. After an initial diagnosis of acute gastroenteritis, Raymond continued to decline and was diagnosed with multiple systems failure. According to court documents, he had excessive nausea and vomiting, loose stools, skin rash, edema, which is swelling due to inflammation, dehydration, bone marrow damage, blood cell abnormalities, electrolyte abnormality, progressive shortness of breath, respiratory failure, rapid heartbeat, low blood pressure, kidney malfunction and shutdown, and numbness and tingling in his hands and feet. But by June 5th, Raymond was doing better, and the doctor told him and Blanche that he would be going home in a few days, after he had to have a procedure. Like other parts of his body, his penis had swelled and become inflamed. A urinary tract infection led to an infection on the foreskin, and now Raymond had to undergo a painful circumcision. On June 13th, Raymond's kidneys started failing. He couldn't produce urine. The doctor wanted him transferred to North Carolina Baptist Hospital in the hopes that doctors there could work out what was causing the symptoms. Baptist had a specialist in internal medicine and nephrology, a doctor who studied the functions of the kidneys. On June 21st, a code blue was alerted when Raymond stopped breathing. He was revived, but now he was on a ventilator and was paralyzed. It's important to note here that author Jim Schutz spoke with many of the nurses who would later testify at trial, and he learned that Blanche had charmed them. Rather than being demanding, as family members can be, or ignoring them completely, she brought in trays of cookies and got on a first-name basis with his caregivers. It was clever, because they didn't suspect a thing when Blanche brought Raymond homemade banana pudding and peanut butter milkshakes. Whenever she brought him food, she brought the nurse's food in a different container. She was even friendly and seemed helpful to the doctors. She was the one who actually suggested Guillain-Barré syndrome. It is a rare disorder in which your body's immune system attacks your nerves, Weakness and tingling in your extremities are usually the first symptoms. These sensations can spread quickly, even paralyzing your whole body. In short, Guillain-Barré looks similar to arsenic poisoning. Blanche had done her homework. One of his doctors sent his urine for a screening, and it did show high levels of arsenic. But Raymond was being treated by several doctors, and this lab report became lost in his voluminous chart. If they had seen this report, they would have known that Raymond was being poisoned while he was in the hospital. He was moved from Wesley to Baptist. He was not home to self-dose himself. The levels were too high, meaning they were recent. Someone was poisoning him at the hospital. But they did not see the lab report, and that would be fatal for Raymond Reed. Instead, his doctors worked with the diagnosis of Guillain-Barré syndrome, and Raymond showed some improvement after undergoing plasmapheresis. It is a grueling process stretched over a day, because how it works is blood is removed from the patient, and then a machine separates the red blood cells and plasma. Then the machine basically rebuilds the blood, using red and white blood cells from the patient and putting them in a laboratory solution rather than the patient's own plasma. Then the machine pumps the now clean blood back into the patient. And it did seem to help Raymond. He was able to go off the ventilator and onto a respirator so he could breathe independently. And his paralysis seemed to lessen also. By September, Raymond seemed to be getting better. Blanche now worked to get his will changed to include her along with his two sons. She had a lawyer draft up a will, and they took it to Raymond's bedside. Raymond was not able to talk, and he communicated that he understood the will by nodding. Raymond was still paralyzed and unable to sign the document, so the lawyer signed for him with a notary public and two nurses as witnesses. A power of attorney was also completed the same way. Blanche was named the executor and beneficiary of Raymond's estate. She would also receive a portion of his life insurance payout. According to ABC 11, on October 1st, the head nurse of the ICU saw Blanche help Raymond eat some of her homemade banana pudding, and by October 3rd, he once again was having trouble breathing. She later testified that he said, "Please help me, or I'm going to die." He was moved back to the ICU the next day, and Raymond's family were told on the 6th that they should come and say their goodbyes. Raymond's son said he could barely recognize his father. Raymond was swollen, even in his eyeballs, and his skin was starting to split from all the blisters. Raymond Reed died on October 7th, 1986. His cause of death was listed as heart failure, and doctors wondered if he had suffered from Guillain-Barré syndrome. They wanted to perform an autopsy to get to the bottom of what happened to Raymond. But Blanche did not want an autopsy, saying Raymond's body had been through enough and he wouldn't want one. His sons were in shock, and she bullied them into agreeing with her. So no autopsy was performed on Raymond Reed. As I said, Reverend Dwight Moore accompanied Blanche to the funeral service and then burial at Pine Hill Cemetery in Burlington. During all this time, Dwight claimed to believe that Blanche was just good friends with Raymond, and she felt she had to take care of him. But Dwight and Blanche were having a sexual relationship, and the preacher did not feel right about not being married. In early November, just a month after Raymond's death, Dwight bought Blanche an engagement ring, and they planned to get married at his church right after Thanksgiving services. But then, Dwight mysteriously fell ill. He kept vomiting violently. The couple postponed their wedding, and Dwight underwent two operations on his intestines. These operations seemed to work, and the couple did marry on April 19, 1989, in a small wedding with two of Reverend Moore's church members serving as witnesses. They were also the only guests. They went on a short honeymoon, just a long weekend away in New Jersey. Dwight had family there and a grandchild he had never met. Back at home on April 24th, Dwight did some chores around the house and ate a fast food chicken sandwich that Blanche brought him. He was hospitalized that night with the same symptoms as before. He was transferred to the ICU at North Carolina Memorial Hospital, and his family was told to prepare themselves for the worst. This was a larger hospital, and doctors noticed symptoms that Raymond's doctors had been confused by. They ordered a full toxicology report on Dwight. His arsenic levels were at 126 times the normal level. At the time, it was the highest level recorded in someone who had survived arsenic poisoning. Dwight had ingested a deadly amount of arsenic. He was lucky to be alive, and now the doctors knew how to treat him: by dialysis, chelating agents, replacement of red blood cells, and bowel cleansing. And they also put a sitter in his room. No one, including Blanche, was allowed to be alone with Dwight. According to the Greensboro News and Record, on May 21, 1989, police were able to interview Dwight. They asked if there was anyone else who had been linked to Blanche who had died under odd circumstances. Dwight admitted that Blanche had a friend named Raymond Reed who died after suffering similar symptoms. And now the police were looking into Blanche Taylor Moore, the good Christian grandmother, a preacher's wife. According to the United Press International, now on UPI.com archives, police looked at death records for 22 people that Blanche knew, and they decided to exhume those they believed Blanche had murdered. They decided to exhume the bodies of Raymond Reed, Parker Kaiser, Blanche's father, James Taylor, her ex-husband, and Isla Taylor, her ex-mother-in-law. Raymond Reed was exhumed on June 13th. His body was well-preserved, and an autopsy showed he had arsenic levels that were 30 times higher than normal, and in his brain, they were 67 times higher than normal. He also had what are called Mies lines on his fingernails. These are almost like rings of a tree. They can tell how many times someone was poisoned and help with the timeline. A sample of his hair narrowed it down further. They found that he had ingested an enormous amount of arsenic on June 24, 1986, while he was still hospitalized. Blanche's first husband, James Taylor, was exhumed on July 6th, and an autopsy showed 60 times the normal level of arsenic in his system. It was definitely enough to kill him. Parker Kaiser and Isla Taylor were both exhumed, and both autopsies showed high levels of arsenic, though they were not found to be lethal in Isla. Parker, or PD, was an alcoholic and smoker with heart and blood pressure issues, and Isla had been an 83-year-old woman with many ailments. It's possible that arsenic sped up the process of their deaths, but it was not provable in court in Isla's case. They also exhumed an old co-worker of Blanche's from Kroger, but his autopsy did not show poisoning. As I said, the police looked into 22 deaths of people connected to Blanche. When the police showed Dwight the evidence against Blanche, he finally believed them. She had already been arrested on July 18th and held in the Alamance County Jail, but Dwight had firmly insisted she had not poisoned him. Now he knew what she was. He filed for divorce in December of 1990, 9 months after he fell sick, 6 months after Blanche was actually arrested, and 1 month after her trial. Blanche was charged with 2 counts of murder for her father, Parker Kaiser, and her former husband, James Taylor, in Alamance County. She was also indicted for felonious assault against Dwight in that county. For the murder of Raymond Reed, she was indicted in Forsyth County, where he died. After this, and much legal wrangling, because district attorneys were passing this complicated case like a hot potato, all of the Alamance County cases were transferred to Forsyth. Blanche would first go on trial for Raymond's murder. They had the best evidence in his case. Aside from the autopsy, Scores of witnesses, from nurses to family members, would testify against Blanche. On August 29th, Blanche entered a not guilty plea. Police believed Blanche killed each man to be with a new one, as evidenced by her series of affairs. But it is not known if there was another man she was planning on leaving Dwight for. On October 15th, 1990, Blanche's trial began in Forsyth County. The prosecution's case was that Blanche began poisoning Raymond with arsenic in early 1986 and kept doing it through his hospitalization by bringing in homemade food. Lead prosecutor Janet Branch said Blanche was, quote, evil, immoral, duplicitous, and manipulative. The prosecution introduced evidence that Blanche killed her first husband, James, in a similar manner to how she killed Raymond. They also said she was working her way towards murdering her current husband, Dwight, as well. Blanche would poison them by putting arsenic in their food and then take care of them while they were sick by giving them more poisoned food. The judge allowed this evidence in by Rule 404B of the North Carolina Rules of Evidence. Similar in what happened at Elsie Underwood's trial, the judge decided that the pattern was strong enough to admit the other two cases into evidence, though he had ruled against joining all of the cases for one trial. The prosecution was not allowed to introduce evidence about Blanche's father or mother-in-law. Though they were found to have arsenic in their bodies, Isla's levels were low. Parker's were high, but it was some 20 years before the trial. It was much harder to show a pattern. But the prosecution did not push for those murders to be added. They feared that if Blanche was charged in her father's murder, then the allegations of abuse and that he forced her into prostitution would be allowed in also. Blanche had confided to her latest husband, Dwight, the things her father had done to her. But to my knowledge, Dwight never spoke publicly about what she said or gave any details. Newspapers reported that in opening arguments, the prosecution gave two motives: that Blanche murdered the men because she had become interested in another lover, the Black Widow angle, or two, that she murdered the men because she subconsciously abhorred men because of her father, Parker Kaiser. He is only called an adulterer who abandoned his family. There was no mention of abuse. But there was obviously a third motive easily proved, and it was used in sentencing. Blanche inherited a third of Raymond Reed's estate by getting that quickie will done while he was in the hospital. She had bought her home that burned down with the money she inherited after she murdered James Taylor. And as Dwight's wife, she stood to inherit his estate once he was dead. It's interesting to note that Dwight first had symptoms near their original wedding date. Maybe she was planning to poison him slowly, and his symptoms did not reappear until after they married the following April. He testified against his then estranged wife at trial, frail and emotional. He said his wife even asked him to buy anti-ant for her, actually showing him the bottle she wanted. Other witnesses said she often recommended anti-ant at Kroger to customers. This poison, used to get rid of ants, was actually arsenic. The defense's entire case was that all the evidence was circumstantial. No one saw Blanche poison anyone. They said she was a good Christian woman who had been devoted to the men in her life. There was a supposed confession that the prosecution won the right to enter into evidence. A man named Garvin Thomas, who was homeless and tried to visit Blanche in jail many times, supposedly wrote the letter. It was only after he died that Blanche produced the letter. The prosecution had handwriting analysts compare the letter to known writings of Garvin Thomas, and then had Blanche write out the letter. Author Jim Schutz got the good details on this matter. Prosecutor Janet Branch was the first one to believe that Blanche actually wrote it herself. It wasn't just the handwriting, but her speech patterns. After going on and on about how much he loved Blanche, detailing how he poisoned the men in her life because he was jealous, and repeatedly calling her a Christian woman, He ended the letter obscenely. Quote, I would like to hold you in my arms and kiss your lips and take off your clothes and kiss your breasts and run my tongue down your pussy and suck up those sweet juices from your body and fuck fuck till morning. This was a hallmark of Blanche's personality. She was known to make crude jokes and obscene remarks. Many quotes of hers are littered through Mr. Schutz's book. That's why Janet Branch fought to introduce the letter herself and get analysts from the SBI to investigate it. Handwriting analysis is not a perfect science, but for one thing, Garvin Thomas did not write in cursive, and Blanche did. Also, the abbreviations used for towns and counties were exactly the way Blanche abbreviated these places in her own letters from jail. Janet Branch also noticed it was the exact same type of envelope that all of Blanche's other letters were mailed in. She had the letter blown up and shown to the jury with handwriting samples. It was compelling evidence. For the defense, Dr. Jesse McNeil, Blanche's psychiatrist, testified that Blanche, quote, did not fit any of the psychological profiles for psychological disorders that are associated with criminal behavior. But Dr. McNeil did say that Blanche was depressed and suicidal. She felt like she didn't have control over her life. She was upset about getting sexually harassed at work, and she no longer wanted to be with Raymond. Blanche was dissatisfied and resented Raymond. She called him whiny. She felt like Raymond was too dependent on her, and he was jealous when she spent time with her daughters. But the most compelling evidence at trial was Blanche herself. After all of the testimony from credible nurses who said they saw Blanche feeding Raymond, she outright denied ever feeding him anything in the hospital. She did not leave herself any room to explain. She just outright denied it. Jim Schutz points out in Preacher's Girl that at this point, everyone thought Prosecutor Janet Branch would go in for the kill. Instead, she rested her case. She believed that she didn't need the drama with Blanche, that Blanche had just lied and closed the case for her. She was right. On November 14, 1990, Blanche was found guilty of the first-degree murder of Raymond Reed. On November 16th, she was sentenced to death. All of her appeals were denied. As she had gotten the death penalty, the other cases were never tried. There was a new district attorney, and he could not see justifying the cost. At this recording, 87-year-old Blanche Taylor Moore is still alive. She is incarcerated in the North Carolina Institution for Women. Blanche is not on the list for executions in 2020. She is one of three women on death row in North Carolina, and she will more than likely die in prison. In 2010, the Winston-Salem Journal did a story on Dwight. The article said that Dwight spent 2.5 months in the hospital recuperating from the poisoning. His limbs were left numb and partially paralyzed. The 2010 article said that for the last 20 years, Dwight had been living in a small Virginia town. He was still preaching, and he remarried to a woman named Faye on May 6, 2001. He liked to garden and read and watch TV. Dwight's near-death experience with Blanche rarely comes up. He said, quote, I don't have any need to see her executed. It doesn't matter to me. Dwight passed away on January 11, 2013. And there is another sad death somewhat related to this case. Janet Branch, though she won a conviction, faced harsh criticism from the public, and especially the Taylor family, because Blanche was not charged in Isla Taylor's death. She had also teared up in court during Reverend Dwight Moore's testimony about his suffering. She had to abruptly leave the room. The defense moved for a mistrial when this happened, but the judge plainly told them that he had seen many attorneys cry in court. When the jury was polled, they didn't think she was crying. One said they thought she had lost a contact. This point would later be brought up in Blanche's appeals, but was always disregarded. According to the Charlotte Observer, in 1993, Janet Branch was reprimanded by the North Carolina State Bar after allegations arose that she was negotiating a movie deal during the trial. They, quote, found no evidence of impropriety, but she was still formally reprimanded. A movie was made called The Black Widow Murders, The Blanche Taylor Moore Story. It is actually based on Jim Schutz's book, and I watched it. It ends with Blanche, played by Elizabeth Montgomery, being arrested and taken away. It doesn't even go into the trial, and I wonder if that is because of Janet Branch. It is some good trash TV, like many that were made at the time. Actress Elizabeth Montgomery told the Washington Post that it bordered on black comedy. Janet Branch had moved on into private practice in Fayetteville after leaving the DA's office in 1991. Her by-then ex-husband had custody of their child because she had a mental breakdown in 2011. In 2015, she walked into traffic on a busy interstate after wrecking her car into a median. Her death was ruled a suicide because of statements she made to a neighbor the night before. Obviously, her death is not related to Blanche, but I found it to be a sad footnote in this awful Southern Gothic story. Blanche Taylor Moore remains an enigma. I think there is merit to the theory of childhood trauma, especially sexual abuse. She was promiscuous, often inappropriately discussing sex in an obscene way, making friends, family, and co-workers uncomfortable. She lied very casually. She reacted harshly and quickly when angry. She has often been called a psychopath. That word, as well as sociopath, both fall under the more clinically accepted diagnosis of antisocial personality disorder. And she ticks off many of the criteria: superficial charm, lying, manipulation, lack of remorse, sexual promiscuity, impulsivity, and so on. I will have articles about childhood sexual abuse, as well as psychopathy or antisocial personality disorder, in the show notes. You can read for yourself. But there is one thing we can be sure of. Blanche was a serial killer. And it started with her father in 1962, giving even more weight to the abuse she may have suffered. Then possibly her mother-in-law in 1970, and then her first husband in 1973. She had gotten away with it at least twice. Now she had a taste for it. Maybe she did hate men, as the prosecution suggested. One thing we can be sure of is that it all started with her daddy. Happy Father's Day. Southern Fried True Crime is written and produced by me, Erica Kelly. The original graphic art is by Coley Horner, and Southern Fried's original music is by Rob Harrison of Gamma Radio. Southern Fried's audio is edited by Chaz Gray of Gray Multimedia. I highly recommend the book Preacher's Girl, The Life and Crimes of Blanche Taylor Moore by Jim Schutz. He has the kind of access to friends and family members that can't be found in court transcripts, though many family members did speak to the press. Thanks to listeners Greg Husketh and Candace Elliott for suggesting today's case. And remember to subscribe to the other show I narrate, Fetal Abduction, a true crime podcast. I'd like to remind you to come join my Facebook group. We share memes and talk about all things Southern and have a lot of laughs. It's a really fun community, and we'd love to have you. Hashtag no shit asses allowed. If you enjoyed today's show, don't forget to subscribe and please tell a friend or rate and review on iTunes. I'm also on most large platforms like Stitcher and Spotify, as well as Stitcher Premium, where you can listen ad-free. If you have any case suggestions, please email southernfriedtruecrime@gmail.com. I no longer answer private messages on social media. With managing three platforms, it is too overwhelming. But please feel free to reach out by email. Not only do I get my most interesting and little-known cases from listener suggestions, I love hearing from you guys. As always, I stand with all people of color and the LGBTQ community. I stand for change in this broken country. We will continue to fight. Until next time, thanks so much for listening. Wash your hands, stop touching your face, and y'all take care.